Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
We're back. It's August 6th, 2022. Can you believe it? If you're listening to this podcast, you probably are missing out on some of the electrifying speeches at CPAC this weekend. That said, we're going to go in a different direction. We're going to turn the wheel left, if you will. So I think I want to talk about stagnant wages. A lot of people may not realize. Of course, our listeners realize, but wages have been declining since 1966. So out of the criticism of the Reagan administration, these discussions and issues were being brought to light. And so we're going to go back to the early 1980s and talk about how the wages began to tumble once Ronald Reagan became first-term president. And this clip is 490. And hit it, Mike.
You talk about revolution. Oh, that's fine. But what are you going to be doing come the time? Are you going to be the big man for Tommy Gunn?
Sorry.
the overworked American subtitled The Unexpected Decline of Leisure by Juliet Shore has gotten, it's got a pretty good review in the Wall Street Journal, as a matter of fact. And
it's surprising.
It also had a review in the New York Times book review section too. But
the corporate executives must feel overworked as well.
Well, the book doesn't deal with the reverse of this, which is the CEOs are working less and making more these days. But that's exactly what's happened. Maybe because we're going to find that the union is a factor here. The union has gotten weaker. But there must be a CEO's union, which obviously has gotten stronger. So it's kind of offsetting that.
Yeah, the CEO's union is called the system. It's called capitalism, right?
The round table, the business round table. Well, she's done some research that the reviewers seem to agree is unusual, different, and novel, something that hasn't been done. But what she's saying is that beginning sometime in the 50s, people began to work more and more and not really earn proportionally more and more. And she says that has reached a point now where there are substantial increases in the amount of work that's being done. She says that all American workers are subject to this, but she documents and also says that the real one that's lost here are women. That women are now working 309 hours a year longer than they used to. The average worker is working 160 some odd. The male worker is working about 93 hours. And these are a lot longer hours than European workers are working, and they're not making any more for it.
There was a big changeover in, I guess, in the 70s, perhaps gradually, but more in the 70s and the 80s, really we saw it, and that is that the families had to have two incomes in order to survive. I remember back in the 50s, when I was a young man, I supported a family on $400 a month. But now it requires at least two incomes, sometimes three or even four.
Well, that calls up another book that we're looking at here called America, What Went Wrong, which came out of a long series of articles in the Philadelphia Inquirer. And one of the important and interesting points that came out of that was that there were 300,000 lost jobs in manufacturing during the 80s. And what's happened is you're losing the high-paying jobs and you're gaining the low-paying jobs. And that's, and women, of course, have always been discriminated against as workers. Therefore, the women are the ones having to go into these low-paying jobs, and they can't even make it on one job. Some of them are working three jobs in order to make it.
In fact, there's another factor here which has to do with the divorce rate and the way this is impacted on women. There's a tremendous amount of single family parents that happen to be women that are forced to support a family and thus to go out and work as well as take care of the family. I read statistics that as many as one out of three families in this country are single parent families in which the woman is the sole provider. So this, too, has forced women into the workplace.
Well, more than ever, I think, these women are forced to go out and get minimum wage-paying jobs. And there just aren't the kind of good jobs, and these people haven't had the kind of professional training that would carry them beyond that. So they're not just working one job. They're working maybe two and maybe three. And I think the important thing that we've got to think about is here's the quail whining about family values,
right.
And yet why isn't he whining about the fact that these women are the ones he's talking about who are victimized by this system? And who are doing the victimizing? Well, corporate employers are doing the victimizing.
Is it also the case that women are only getting paid 60% on the dollar compared to men's salaries? Now is popularizing that figure as recently as a couple years ago. And I haven't seen that there's been any changes in this.
That it doesn't seem to change, although I don't think those kind of facts are in these books here. What's there is the fact that we've had the loss of high-paying jobs and big gain in really low-paying jobs, and therefore overwork is increased and payment is decreased.
Okay, now why would an employer want to have his people working, say, time and a half because he has to pay him more?
Well, There's documentation for the fact that fringe benefits have gone up in the last 25 years from 17 to 35% of wages. So what he's trying to do is avoid bringing a new employee on, putting him on a new expensive health plan, putting him on an expensive retirement plan, and he just doesn't have to do that. And when he can force his employee to work overtime, even though the employee may not want to work overtime.
Well, it's gone the other direction in some industries like fast food, where they purposefully only hire a very few full-time employees so that they don't have to pay any of these fringe benefits.
Any fringe benefits.
Yeah. Right. Well, you actually see it in the community colleges like here in Austin, where they hire almost, part-time teachers. They may teach three courses.
Or five, even.
Or, yeah, but they don't get benefits, and they pay, $1,000 a course, something like that.
Well,
that's less than minimum wage.
This points out the fact that there isn't any freedom to choose or not choose overtime, except there is some freedom in these low-paying, entry-level, minimum or less minimum wage jobs. There, of course, people can work part-time, but you can't work part-time in a good job because your employer won't let you. He just won't, even though it may make economic sense, even though productivity may be equal or greater, he won't do it. And he doesn't do it because he just doesn't want that arrangement.
Nothing's changed for all the deaths of their ideas created. It's just the same for shifty games, but the rules aren't clearly stated.
Thank you. in hell.
Hey,
you need to
stop.
Like
another human.
You shouldn't hit me. You should not hit me, sir.
Don't throw me.
You should not hit me.
How many babies have you fucking killed?
Should you not hit me?
How many babies?
You should not hit me.
How many babies have you killed? You have no problem.
You need to back off now. No, don't.
You come in my little town, put up your stupid fucking sign.
I live here.
Sir.
She lives here.
You're a bunch of communist motherfuckers.
We're not.
You need to stop.
You kill babies.
Sir, you need to stop.
You kill babies. Every fucking one.
You need to stop. You need to stop. Or you're going to end up in trouble with the law. It's illegal to hit people still. It's illegal to hit people still in the United States.
Oh, you
will
just fuck you.
Illegal.
Purple hair, son of a bitch.
Yeah, stay back. Stay back.
I am not, but they are executing their First Amendment right to do what they want.
Sir,
you cannot get involved in that.
You're a bunch of baby-killing motherfuckers.
Okay,
all of you.
But you need to
stop. Thousands of babies have been killed because you motherfuckers think it's okay to kill babies.
You are causing a problem.
Go away right now. You go away right now. This is my house. This is where I live.
Whoa.
This is my home. Get away from here.
You need,
now.
You need,
look me in the
you
eyes.
Need to back
get
off.
Away from
who the hell
now.
Are you?
You need
this
to
is
back
my town.
Off.
This is my
What's your
where
name?
My town, too.
What's your
this
name?
Is where I live.
I don't
anyway.
Your name.
You're not
right
a green hippie.
What is
you're
your name?
You're all a bunch
here,
of fucking
this way.
Babies.
Let's walk this way.
Should they come for you? Should they come for you?
Let's walk this way. Let's walk this way.
You're a bunch of...
Right here.
Come on.
Right here.
Let's walk
you're
this way.
You're a bunch of baby-killing motherfuckers.
Walk
so,
away.
I'm going to
walk
away. I'll talk to him.
Yeah, good.
I think it would be an interesting point to start with kind of an overview on the people that you interact with in these extremist movements. So my first question for you is, what has surprised you most about the individuals that you've reported on and interviewed that are involved in these militia and extremist movements around the country?
So I've definitely covered a sort of mixed buffet of far-right extremists from, again, like I said, the suit and tie white nationalists, to the sort of hardcore neo-Nazis who are maybe what you think of or what you used to think of when you thought of, you know, the far-right extremists. the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys, you know, which are the, you know, for people who don't know, are the anti-government kind of insurgent group who wear Hawaiian shirts and AR-15s, then to the more kind of traditional militia groups. And then also, I think probably one of the most troubling, and maybe this is what I found most surprising because it's, I found them the most troubling, is the intersection between extremism, extremist ideas, and mainstream politics. And I think that's, this is what we really saw throughout 2020 with the anti-lockdown protests, and how kind of the fringe grievances driving some of those protests were being echoed at the highest levels of government, to some of the language and rhetoric and organizing in response to Black Lives Matter in the summer, and then the Stop the Steal movement, which, you know, brought us up to the January 6th. So I think that seeing that kind of joining of forces between extremists and ordinary people, I guess I found the most troubling.
Back at 7:25 in the Midwest. So that was PJ Harvey from about 1993, and before that was Crass, but I think I got a lot of PJ Harvey this weekend that I'm going to be playing, and I found one that was a live performance that I think really reflected her dynamic range. And so I hope you all like that. So John Stewart has been kicking up a little dust, and there's rumor that he might be running for a U.S. Senate seat I don't know. I don't know if he could take the pay cut. But anyway, so, you know, he was talking about, you know, the illnesses from the burn piles, the burn pits in the Iraq War. And so I was trying to find a good take on it, and Amy Goodman had the best one. And so I think we'll let Amy Goodman start it, and then we're going to do I got Neil Young, Cortez the Killer, and I've tried to find somebody to do a better version of Cortez the Killer, and it's one of those songs that Neil Young owns, and I'm not sure if I ever find a better version of Cortez the Killer, I will play it. We promise. And then, let's see. And then there's more PJ Harvey on this one. And so go ahead and play it, Mike, 481.
Elsewhere on Capitol Hill, military veterans and their supporters erupted in anger Thursday after Senate Republicans blocked a bill to aid former U.S. service members poisoned by toxic waste. The bill would require the Department of Veterans Affairs to remove the burden of proof from vets who say their health problems are related to the Pentagon's use of toxic burn pits in Iraq and Afghanistan. On Wednesday, Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey, who's set to retire at the end of the year, blocked the bill after it initially received 84 votes in the 100-seat Senate. That prompted an angry response from comedian Jon Stewart, a leading advocate for veterans.
Senate's where accountability goes to die. These people don't care. They're never losing their jobs. They're never losing their health care. Pat Toomey didn't lose his job. He's walking away. God knows what kind of pot of gold he's stepping into to lobby this government to on more people. I'm used to all of it, but I am not used to the cruelty.
Thank you. Hello, I'm from the U.S. government. No, not that. Or that. Your actual government. The Supreme Court. You know, the guys who brought you voter suppression. Citizens United. And this global terrorist. SCOTUS. Even at the best of times, SCOTUS gives zero f***s about democracy. We answer to nobody. We overrule laws made by Congress. Our justices are appointed for life. And you don't even elect us. To be fair, you barely elect the people who do appoint us. But here we are. And now that we finally have enough Federalist Society nutjobs on the bench, we'll be using this court's unchecked power to wrong some rights. Like the right for women to have no control over their own bodies. The right for kids to be indoctrinated at school. The next mass shooter's right to flaunt their weapon in public. And the right for polluters to kill even more of you in heat waves, floods, and fires. But we're only just getting started. In our next term, we'll decide if Republicans have the right to steal the next presidential election. That's right, we'll be ruling on the theory of independent state legislature. Independent state legislature is a judicial fart cooked up by these three bandits who helped steal the 2000 election in what's widely regarded as one of our shittest rulings ever. The theory proposes that during presidential elections, state legislatures have the power to ignore your votes and choose their own electors, which is handy if none of your favorite presidents have won the popular vote this century. And if state courts try to stop this shitfuckery by upholding their constitution, the theory says SCOTUS should step in to decide the outcome of the election. Yep, just like what happened in 2000. History was almost repeated at the last election when Il Duce asked us to use this very theory to invalidate your mail-in ballots in a bunch of swing states. Unfortunately, we didn't quite have the numbers to help him out back then. But now, we do. Trump 24. Brought to you by SCOTUS. Legal experts say it would be hypocritical of us to embrace a law with no constitutional basis after striking down this law for having no constitutional basis. But they overlook a key aspect of our jurisprudence. We don't give a shit. We're just here to impose our fucked up ideology.
Lick out SCOTUS.
What's that? How can you stop us? Well, introducing more justices and term limits would be a start, but that would require an actual majority in both the House and Senate. Better vote in those midterms. Might be the last free election you get. Failing that, you'll have to find a way to show us you're not going to stand for six unelected pieces of shit rat fucking your democracy anymore. You know, general strikes, mass protests, all good things we've been working hard to outlaw. Until then, enjoy the ride as we take you back to 1787, or whatever this frat boy imagines that to be. Probably a cross between Handmaid's Tale and Beer Fest. Whatever. Fuck you.
SCOTUS!
Authorized by the Department for Thinly Disguised Plans to usher in a theocratic Christian regime.
If you'd like to help us keep the bastards honest, you can do so at patreon.com/thejuicemedia.
The court affirmed. But the power to protect unborn life is returned to the people and their elected representatives.
Go home. It's scary when a man seems fit to run the country just by having 10 children. Go home. Your candidate has a name that's really vulgar. Go ahead and Google it. Oh, let me tell you what Santorum is. It's a frothy mix of blue feces and jizz. It is a byproduct of anal. Santorum is so banal, he hardly merits this retort. This futile run, Rick Santorum should abort. Go home, you silly prude. God didn't write the Bill of Rights. It was a bunch of dead white dudes. I know, it is unkind to make fun of foolish virgins, even if it is in rhyme. But evolution's not up for debate, and I won't abide Santorum's words of hate. He wants to take away civil rights. My outrage reaches new heights. I can't believe he's in this fight. Now take a bow, Rick Santorum, say goodnight. Oh, it's crazy, the belief we can't dispel. He really thinks that the gays and I will burn in hell. Oh, shucks, so well. Oh, let me tell you what Santorum is. It's a frothy mix of blue feces and jizz. A woman's body's not his business. His opinion could be less weak. Won that fair and square in court. This is a run, Rick Santorum should abort. This is so fun, I'm just doing it for sport. This is a run, Rick Santorum should abort. Go home.
If the citizenry in America is disarmed, then we are no longer citizens. We are subjects. You know, here in America, we have gourmet treats for puppies. We have these amazing groomers for dogs. Well, in Venezuela, they eat the dogs. And it started because they don't have firearms. They do not have a way to protect themselves, to defend themselves against a tyrannical government.
Thank you.
We're back at 7:46 p.m. in the Midwest. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. You know, I was only kidding when I said it was a slow news week. And maybe Mike and I were talking about that in the green room. So HBO has a show, a series, a documentary called The Anarchist. And most of you folks have been following the show know that we clarified what is an anarchist, and an anarchist is grassroots labor organizing. It's a lot more simple than what it's all made out to be. Well, HBO decided to, there's these guys that follow Ron Paul, and, you know, Rand Paul had a dad. And now Ayn Rand is not Rand Paul's mother. I just want to make that clear. I don't want to be spreading rumors. You know, we like to keep our content top shelf. Okay, so they feature this guy to be what they described as the king of the anarchists, and down in Acapulco, and it's quite a B movie they made for themselves. But anyway, HBO didn't research this guy. And we found 10 minutes of Holocaust denial that we're going to play for you all. And then we were talking about last week about Rod Weber up in Boston at Little Jamaica, the Nationalist Social Club, which is the Nazis in Boston. Their guy got arrested. And so we got the grassroots report on that attached to this, and so I think we might have a little more Carol Anderson talking about militia history at the end of that, and so that was PJ Harvey, and PJ's real name is Polly, so like Polly Anders. But anyway, very interesting artists, and a lot of this stuff we're pulling, were performances 30 years ago, but. Anyway, it probably got some more crass or something coming on this clip, but it's 480, so hit it, Mike.
Oh, and I don't want to get too deep into this, 'cause I could probably talk about this for like an hour, because Max has been like giving me all kinds of info I didn't know. But I do want to kind of do a little bit of a, like an apology to some of the people on BitChute who kept saying that Hitler wasn't that bad. Or he was a great man, even, some of them were saying. And some people would say, you're a Jew lover, Jeff, if you think, you know, Hitler wasn't great. Well, Max spent hours with me going over all the info. And yeah, it looks like Hitler was pretty good. So surprised, right? So surprised. He was actually, he got screwed over by the Khazarians, who call themselves Jews. They're not even Jews. They're not those Hasidic Jew people. They're like blonde, blue-eyed people for the most part. And they got them all fucked up in Germany. The Khazarians who were in Germany were doing everything to destroy Germany from inside, very much like what the Jesuits do. It's basically the same thing. And Max was saying, he had excellent information. I'm still going through some of the documentaries and books that he was telling me about. But there was literally no concentration camps. Like I've always said in the past, it wasn't 6 million people, right? But I never really looked into it. And the reason I didn't look into it is, what am I going to do? Like, get a government's history book? It's all lies, right? Like, I know that much. But thanks to Max, he filled me in, and yeah, it was just all lies, everything.
Roxbury this morning, where a member of a neo-Nazi group as well as counter-protesters faced a judge today. Those people called the court over an incident in Jamaica Plain where that neo-Nazi group interrupted an inclusive event. Evan's Madi Salazar is live this afternoon in West Roxbury with the details. Madi.
Amaka, the charges against the counter-protesters were dropped this morning, but the state is sticking with charging the member of the neo-Nazi group.
A member of a neo-Nazi group faced a judge on Monday after protesting during an LGBTQ meeting in Jamaica Plain over the weekend. The state charging the alleged leader of the Nationalist Social Club, 23-year-old Christopher Hood. Prosecutors say Hood and other members of the white supremacist group chanted and tried to hang a banner where there was supposed to be a drag queen story hour.
We're here to tell them to drop the charges.
Demonstrators stood outside West Roxbury District Court in solidarity for the two other counter-protesters arrested that day, one who got into a physical fight with Hood. The charges against those two people were dropped.
We're here to support people that were arrested when they were actually engaging in self-defense against white supremacists and Nazis.
Things got tense outside the courthouse as Hood and his supporters walked in for the arraignment, someone approaching them and then getting into an altercation. That person was taken away by police. People with the LGBTQ community say they want to send a message to the group that this type of hatred won't be tolerated.
Seeing the Nazis is enraging and demoralizing.
The judge is requiring Hood to stay away from those counter-protesters whose charges were dropped today, and he'll be back in court in September. We're live from West Roxbury. Monty Salazar, 7 News.
He just has to get booked, fingerprinted, and then they'll basically call the bail bondsman,
okay,
and they'll say, okay, hey, this is how much his bail is, and if somebody wants to go and bail him out, that's what can happen.
Okay.
If you go there right now, you're going to be waiting for an hour and a half until right, everything's done and settled.
All right.
Hey, you're the one coming near me, pushing up on me,
no,
dude. Right?
Well, what's up?
I mean, so, yeah, nice sewn and rad tattoo, cool, all that stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're for the supremacy of the white race? I mean,
I'm for my people and advocacy for them.
Okay, right on.
That's right.
Sounds good. So I'm curious, when you achieve white utopia.
What white utopia?
Isn't that what NSC 131 is about? Oh, come on. You came up to me and started bumping me, right?
No, I didn't touch you.
Yeah, you sure did.
Oh, no, I didn't.
You sure did, motherfucker.
You're going to find out what happens.
I'm sorry, but you touched me.
Excuse me.
Ma'am, this guy was touching me over here in a way that I don't appreciate.
We don't touch. You do the touching. You're the pedophile. You're the one that's with
me. Oh. Is that right?
Yeah.
How about all you guys over there on the DAA site? Huh?
What?
Yeah, what's the tattoo
you mean,
about?
You mean the pigs getting their heads ripped off?
Yeah.
Anti-cop, fuck the feds, that's what it says.
Oh. So what's up? You did jail time?
Oh, yeah, I did 7.5 years in prison.
For what?
For robbing drug dealers, that's right.
Robbing drug dealers? That's
pretty
nice. Isn't that the DEA does?
So, because you were a drug dealer?
DEA does?
Huh?
Isn't that what the DEA does, though?
I don't know what they do. They're scumbags.
You know what I mean? Like,
They're scumbags, that's all.
Mm, okay.
They wear cameras like that, too.
So what is your name if you're such a hot shot?
Don't need to tell you. You already know who I am.
I'm asking.
You already know who I am.
Come on.
They
want to
be asking if they already knew.
Come on. Do I really know? Do you really know? Who really knows?
What are you guys doing? What are you, the guys act like you're doing something like being doxxed. Oh, my God, I'm doxxed. Oh, my God. You fucking clown.
Is that what we're
doing? Don't worry. It doesn't work. I have my own business. I do very well for myself, and I'm here. What's up? My name's Leo Cullinan. How you doing?
Yeah. So you came up to me pushing me, wearing your little camera. So, I mean...
Well, whenever you invite us over your crib, I mean, if Lauren's interested, that's on you. You guys are free.
Oh, hell yeah. Lauren is all about that shit, bro. We want to see that big pecker of yours. Come on. We know what the steroids do. Come on. I mean,
if you knew what they did and you studied endocrinology, you would know.
Oh, wait a sec. We have an endocrinologist in the house.
Well, whenever you invite us over your crib, I mean, if Lauren's interested. That...
What'd you do?
Yeah.
Huh? Chrissy, what's up? What happened? Come on, Chris. Tell me what happened. What'd you do?
Do me a favor. On the sidewalk.
All right. Nazi cucks. Nazi cucks! Woo! Chris Hood, what's going on? What'd you do?
A Shays Rebellion that happened right before the Constitutional Convention, where white men gathered together to attack the government because they didn't like a taxation policy, and that the militia would not put down these white men. In fact, you had members of the militia joining this rebellion. And you had to have Boston merchants basically finance a mercenary army to put down Shays Rebellion. But what you didn't see coming out of that was a law saying, you know, white men with arms are dangerous. White men with arms attack the government. So we need to ban white men from having access to weapons. You don't see that happening. But you do see that happening with slave revolts. You see the language, the laws coming in place saying they shall not have access, black people shall not have access to weapons, and that the militia and the slave patrol are there to ensure that black people do not have access to weapons. how the right to bear arms, the right to a well-regulated militia, and the right to self-defense are, in fact, fractured. That citizenship is fractured. It is hobbled by this intense anti-blackness, this fear of black people, this sense of black people as a danger to white American society. In Louisiana, when it was still the Louisiana Territory, it was before the U.S. had purchased it, but it was on its way. It was on its way. You had a well-heeled, well-trained black militia that had been very effective. Well, as the U.S. came in, one of the first cries coming out of white New Orleans was to strip the black militia, disband the black militia. Well, the governor, William Claiborne, at the time, you know, at first he's like, yes, you know, asking for more arms because we have all of these free blacks and we've got these black folks with arms. And so he's asking for more arms from the federal government. But then he starts noticing how effective this black militia is. And so he tries to square the circle. White fear and the sense that the black militia is the only real effective fighting force there, given all of the challenges that are happening in that territory at the time. And so what he comes up with is to remove the black officer class from this black militia and put in white officers, thinking that that will be enough for whites in New Orleans who want the black militia disbanded. But then there is a massive, massive slave revolt coming from Charles Deslandes. And this massive slave revolt that included somewhere between 150 to 500 people headed to New Orleans, headed to what they believed was freedom, just sent terror through what is called the German coast of Louisiana. And so William Claiborne, seeing this massive movement, this massive slave revolt, in fact, begins to enlist the black militia as part of the forces to take on this slave revolt. And the slave revolt is crushed. I mean, the U.S. Army comes in, the U.S. Navy comes in. You have the white militia that is there, but the black militia is very effective. And so you have a black militia fighting against black folk who are enslaved and trying to be free. The reward that the black militia received for this was a further push to be disbanded, further push to not have access to be able to purchase arms. They put a law in place that folks of color, black people, could not buy arms. Then came the War of 1812, and Andrew Jackson is the leader, the military leader, and he sees the British coming in this Battle of New Orleans, and he sees this black militia, and he's telling Claiborne, we need them. This is an effective fighting force. And Claiborne's like, yes, they are, but I'm telling you, they're just not feeling it right now because of the way we treat them. And he's like, I will treat them equally. I will treat them with the honor that all soldiers should have, and they will be paid equal to whites. They will receive the same pay. And besides the black militia, I want two additional battalions. Claiborne came back and said, you can get the black militia, but getting two additional battalions is going to be difficult because whites in this area believe that arming them is arming the enemy. So you have black folks who are identified as the enemy. And in that fighting force, that force beat the British. It was like 3,000 or so of Andrew Jackson's troops against 8,000 British troops, and they won. And Andrew Jackson was like, wow, I knew you guys were good. I just didn't know how good. But the response, the reaction to that then was to send them off as a labor battalion to work in the swamps that white men didn't want to go into to do the work. So you have this denigration of black military contributions to fighting for America. And that was a consistent theme that we saw. So you get this erasure of this history, and this erasure for the men themselves who are doing the fighting, who are being wounded, who are dealing with the loss of their fighting brethren. That has been the sense that black men under arms bear a threat. And black men who are trained how to use arms, they're really a threat. So they must be disarmed after they have served our purpose.
until we caught him, London was always going to be at risk.
As the clock ticked, the body count rose.
The effect of the explosion would be even more devastating than the other two attacks.
And with it the question, why did someone so young wage a killing spree against the Capitol?
When a second device goes off almost exactly a week later, then you do quickly start thinking, is there a link?
Because he fundamentally hated anybody who wasn't him, he wouldn't run out of victims to target.
Using the killer's own words.
Could you please explain to me, when you made these devices, what your intent was?
We find out why. London is home to over 8 million people from all over the globe. With a diverse mix of cultures, religion and wealth, spread throughout a network of districts, this vibrant city is continuously alive to the hum of its inhabitants. But during the afternoon of the 30th of April 1999, the buzz of London's lively Soho district was about to be silenced. As another busy week came to an end, workers had begun to descend on the many bars and clubs the popular area had to offer, celebrating the start of the weekend. A popular place to unwind was one of Soho's oldest pubs, the Admiral Duncan.
It reminded me of like a Cornish smuggler's pub down on the coast.
The Admiral Duncan on Old Compton Street had been trading since the early 19th century. In recent years, it had become a popular gay bar. Small and intimate, it was known for its friendly and welcoming atmosphere, and would often fill up with drinkers early on a Friday afternoon. But on this afternoon, the clientele were unaware that only minutes earlier, an individual had been drinking amongst them, whose sole intention was to cause enormous harm to everyone there. 6:35 p.m. Inside the Admiral Duncan, a black bag lay at the feet of those drinking at the bar. It had been placed approximately 20 minutes earlier.
I actually stood right at the back of the pub, which was my usual sort of bolt hole, just beside the jukebox. I didn't actually hear a loud bang, a blue flash, and then an odd sort of noise as if kind of like cabling was being ripped out of the ceiling.
Within a matter of minutes, the upbeat, happy atmosphere had been torn apart, replaced by a bloody scene of carnage. Photographer Chris Taylor was only streets away when the explosion happened and managed to capture images of the immediate aftermath. The bomb inside the black bag had been packed with hundreds of nails, which had ripped through the small space. Three people were killed by the explosion, including a woman who was 4 months pregnant at the time. Four lost limbs, and 70 others were injured. The bomb left to detonate inside the Admiral Duncan pub had been the third explosion in a series of similar blasts across London over the past 2 weeks. On the 15th of May 1976, David Copeland was born in the West London suburb of Hanworth. The middle child of three brothers, he was noticeably different from his siblings, being significantly smaller than both, causing an early inferiority complex.
He wasn't very outgoing, he was shy and withdrawn sometimes, so he felt massively inadequate relative to everybody else.
From the age of about 12, he'd begun to have dreams of violence. He apparently dreamt of killing his schoolmates. He also dreamt of coming back reincarnated as an SS officer, and there seems to have been a strain of violence that was running through him like a sort of submerged river. We do know that nobody at school had any memory of him at all. He made absolutely no impression on the school.
I think it's possibly safe to say that because he was such a nondescript individual who didn't stand out in any way to his peers and his teachers, perhaps that's a sign that he was truly a blank slate.
His festering inner thoughts remained largely undiscovered.
He was an individual who didn't explode and erupt that other people could see, but he harboured that resentment and anger, and that fuelled his fantasies to the extreme direction they took.
The 17th of April 1999, 11 a.m, Farnborough, Hampshire. 7 hours before the deadly spree began, in his bedsit, 22-year-old David Copeland completed the final stages in the construction of a 4-inch pipe bomb.
Up to 1,500 nails had been put in the bomb, turning it into a lethal concoction.
Several years before planting that horrific first bomb in Brixton Market, a teenage David Copeland had become increasingly isolated from those around him. At school, he failed to form any lasting relationships, preferring to spend his time as an invisible pupil. left to his own devices. Few would ever take any notice of him. By late 1995, an increasingly isolated Copeland was getting out of control. His drinking had increased, and he started to take a variety of drugs, including cocaine, crack, and heroin. Unable to commit, Copeland drifted from job to job. Each new job he failed at strengthened a twisted sense of resentment towards the immigrant communities who he believed were stealing the best positions.
Initially, the thought was, in regards to Electric Avenue, was it terrorism? Was it extremism? Was it racism? When a second device goes off almost exactly a week later, then you do quickly start thinking, is there a link, is there a chain, and is there a connection?
They'd had an attack on a black area and now an attack on an Asian area. So the assumption had to be that they were dealing with somebody who would strike again.
So your aim was more than just to plant bombs and hurt people?
That's right, my aim was political. It was to cause a racial war in this country.
2 years earlier, in the late spring of 1997, David Copeland, now 20 years old, had finally managed to secure a solid job as an engineer's assistant with the London Underground. The job paid well, but the work had meant moving from the comfort of his family home in Yateley to a shabby, basic bedsit in the mixed-race community of Newham. Here, Copeland's increasingly racist views boiled over.
He began to take interest in political groups. He started off with British National Party.
For the first time, Copeland finds a group of people who are like-minded to him. They share very similar extreme views. We know that support groups, like-minded individuals with extreme views, can be very seductive, can be a very strong reinforcer.
Whilst attending meetings and activities for the BNP, Copeland became exposed to increasing amounts of far-right literature, including the Terrorist Handbook and the Turner Diaries.
Turner Diaries was an American novel written by a white extremist, a supremacist, and it told about the main characters and protagonists, how they plant bombs and start race wars, and eventually the white race becomes supreme.
But I am a Nazi, I admit that. Yeah, I believe in what I believe in.
Well, what do you believe in, Tom?
National Socialist State, Aryan domination of the world. White races, master race.
Copeland's abhorrent racist views became increasingly affected by what he read, and the literature served to shape his impressionable mind with ever more radical views.
Copeland very quickly joins another extreme group, the National Socialist Movement, and this was an underground group of right-wing extremists and white supremacists who believed that action and terrorism was the way to succeed with their political views.
Here, Copeland is said to have flourished with the like-minded members. And before long, he had made inquiries with his superiors at the party about progressing through the ranks.
Copeland's involvement was possibly the first time in his adult life that he'd been successful at something.
On February the 25th, 1999, Copeland received a letter from the NSM. He had been promoted to unit leader for Hampshire and Wiltshire. Just 7 weeks after receiving his promotion within the National Socialist Movement, Copeland would embark on his spree, planting the first bomb that exploded through Brixton Market.
One of David Copeland's workmates looked at the picture and began to think it bore a resemblance, and eventually, in the late afternoon, around about 5:30, rang the police to tell them that he was concerned about a workmate called David Copeland.
It was the first time David Copeland's name had been linked to the explosions.
Unfortunately, it was too late.
So how did the gay people fit in with your political beliefs then?
Because they're different, you know, I mean, they're wrong, they're perverted, they're degenerates.
They surrounded the house where he lived in the bedsit, and what they found was an extraordinary room decorated with a large swastika, pictures, cuttings from the first two bombs plastered on the wall.
He almost readily admits that he has been expecting them. He's the bomber, working alone. He wanted to talk. He told us how he made the devices, why he did it, and it was driven by this part to being known. He believed in this Aryan state, and he was a racist.
The trial to convict Copeland of murder and causing explosions began on the 5th of June 2000.
I remember coming in on the first day of that court case, court number one at the Old Bailey, perhaps the most famous courtroom in the world, and there in the rows were the victims, one or two in wheelchairs, others with obvious injuries, packed rows of people who'd suffered because of it.
On the 30th of June 2000, having lasted only 19 days, the trial was brought to a close. Copeland was convicted of 3 counts of murder and 3 of causing explosions. He received 6 life.
Thank you. choice, brother?
Heroin.
Crystal meth.
Meth and heroin.
All right, I was about 9 years old when crack cocaine kind of hit the streets of Detroit in 1984, and I lived and grew up next to a liquor store in the middle of Detroit, so I'm well-versed. Some new drugs have had quite an impact, not only on L.A., but it's spreading around the country, fentanyl, meth. But this so-called Skid Row, which is we're right near the border of Mexico, where they're making fentanyl and crystal meth, and that's what they love. And the peak, one of the peak years of the so-called cocaine epidemic, say 1989 or 90, there was only about 5,000 or so total drug overdose deaths in the United States. You know how many there were last year? 108,000. You know, most of that is being caused by opioids, but really fentanyl. And just one of my longtime guests, or multiple-time guests, Ryan Leone, the last time I interviewed him a couple months ago, he was stopping and stepping outside to take breaks of smoking his $5 blue fentanyl pills off of aluminum foil. He OD'd a few weeks back. And the fentanyl is coming largely in that pill form now. In Inglewood, just not a few miles from here, they just caught a million fake oxys yesterday. A million fake oxys. And, but we know about fentanyl, but then here in L.A., fentanyl's in a lot of everywhere, the new meth. And the meth is not new, but what is new is the volume and purity of this real perfected kind of meth. So meth has some effects that make you overheat and your heart beat fast, which actually kind of good because that controls a person's usage, but some of this new stuff that's real pure, you just get the high effect and your body's not signaling you shouldn't be doing it, and you have all these people in these weird psychoses. There were 15,000 meth deaths, overdoses last year, which again, that's triple the most, that was 5,000 of all overdoses. That's probably four or five times more than any year's worth of cocaine deaths. And here on the streets of L.A., I think the pounds are for as low as 2,000 or less. Or I might have read 1,000 per pound of meth. And the other, and it's the spread of these drugs, usage and trafficking around the country. It's also tied in with this anti-government, defund the police, bail reform. So just the other day in Manhattan, two guys named Mr. Estrada and Mr. Santos got caught with 150 pounds of crystal meth, which would be worth several million dollars on the streets of the Rotten Apple, probably picked up here for 200 grand if it came from Mexico, you know, probably more like 50 grand. You know, in the age of cocaine, heroin, marijuana, those are plants that a government could interdict if you feel like the usage is getting out of control. But even with cocaine, when they interdicted on availability of ether, that's when you really saw crack start to rise, because the cocaine, it was hard to make into that crystalline powdery substance people wanted to snort, and it began coming gummy, like as if it was meant to be cooked into crack, which it was because they couldn't process it as well. But with meth and the fentanyl now, they're able to get precursor chemicals that are part of all sorts of industrial processes that you can't clamp down on, and they're making them in little homemade labs right across the border. Both fentanyl and crystal meth cost them almost nothing to make. They don't care if they lose a load. And wherever potent, super cheap meth is prevalent, L.A. being number one, it's probably adding to the crazy behavior outside, maybe even the people choosing to live outside. Healthcare professionals are seeing people behave in public more extreme ways than I ever have. It's one thing to be mentally ill, but where does the superhuman energy come from in some of these videos? Some of these people are like zombies from The Walking Dead. Meth got synthesized in the early 1900s, but first came into widespread use like during World War II. German and Japanese soldiers are using it, maybe American. After the war, when Japan was trying to build its economy, a lot of its people were using it just to go to work. Like 3% of the population was addicted. Now, in the U.S., traditionally it got manufactured and distributed by bikers. In the early 2000s, those small labs started popping up in a lot of states, especially in the West, but in the Midwest as well. When I was in jail in Phoenix, they were giving out 9-year sentences for having labs like candy. But after 2006, the guys from the other side of the border started building super labs up in the states to beat out the local mom and pop, if you will. The Flores twins, the guys who snitched on El Chapo, they did a single deal where they bought certain chemicals from Chinese suppliers in Mexico for $24 million, and then they smuggled them into America and sold them for $80 million in one fell swoop, a $56 million profit in one deal. Now, one lab that was raided not long ago had enough chemicals on hand to produce an estimated 900 metric tons of meth. That's 1.8 million pounds. At even a profit of, say, $1,000 a pound, I, off the top of my head, I think that's $1.8 billion in gross profit from one lab. Now, down in Sinaloa, home of El Chapo, capital of meth production, the cartels don't just run the business, they tax other people in it. All sorts of small businessmen are getting in on the action. They might pay for a 50-pound load. The cartel is paid to get it over the border and deliver it to the guy's cousin in, say, Atlanta. And he's now this new super pure meth has normally has euphoric effects, but it also makes your heart race and body overheat, so it kind of controls your use. But this new super pure meth is manufactured so well that heart racing is a thing of the past, so there's probably people using it heavier and heavier, so they're not sleeping and they're developing the symptoms that chronic users of meth are really exhibiting now all across the country. Violent paranoia, hallucinations, conspiracy theories, massive memory loss, jumbled speeches. I've been here since 2016 and I've seen Skid Row go from being fairly contained.
Somebody has estimated that the actual cost when we start paying back to taxpayers is going to be $25 billion a year from now on, forever. Think about what $25 billion every year, what we could have used for that. And then when you think about the money was basically looted and stolen, and that Congress and the Justice Department are not trying to get it back. And that's one of the keys to all this, is tracing the money and also trying to recover it. And there's been none of that. I mean, Congress doesn't want to do it because they're involved up to their eyeballs. When you start tracing this money, like you did with the Keating Five, you find it comes in, some of it comes back to their own campaign, chests. And the Justice Department, which is controlled by the president, of course, has not tried to track the money. They're interested in just getting the front men and the cutouts and the middlemen to cop guilty pleas and go to jail maybe for a year or two, and then go on to the next one. So they rack up all these convictions, but they don't try to really figure out what happened and where the money went and who benefited.
Pete, one of the reasons why the government has not done any real prosecution or investigation of this scandal is because they've been involved in it, going all the way to the top up to George Bush. We didn't really get into last time the complicity of George Bush's son, Neil, in a SNL scandal, the Silverado case. Perhaps we can go into that as an illustration of how the SNL scandal worked and the complicity of top establishment officials in this crisis.
Sure. We all know that Neil was a director of Silverado Savings in Denver, Colorado, and that when he was on the board of directors, he was being supported financially by a couple of Denver businessmen named Ken Good and Bill Walters. At the same time, Walters and Good were borrowing huge amounts of money from Silverado. And in fact, Neil got his hand slapped in administrative action for approving loans to his business associate, Bill Walters. What we don't know, what hasn't come out really before, are the connections between not only Good and Walters, but to other Silverado borrowers, to mafia people and to the CIA. And we find that if you look at, say, Bill Walters was the largest borrower at Silverado Savings. He signed on about $130 million of loans. In addition, he sold property to Silverado of about $90 million. Walters was a Denver architect. Walters and his partners, including a guy named Richard Rossmiller, were involved in the Texas Rent-A-Bank scandal back in the mid-70s with Herman K. Beebe. I mean, Beebe was and Ben Barnes were involved in deals with these people. And Beebe specifically had transferred about $1 million to Richard Rossmiller, Bill Walters' partner. And they had all owned a bank in Marshall, Texas, that was involved in the Texas Rent-A-Bank scandal. And we find that Walters was also apparently and had been accused of transferring some of his ill-gotten gains to a trust on the Isle of Jersey that was being funneled. Drug money was being laundered through it by people in Miami, and SNL money from people like Robert Corson, the CIA agent, was going through this trust fund. Ken Good who borrowed over $40 million from Silverado and was Neil Bush's sugar daddy for several years, had also borrowed money from Western Savings in Dallas. It was part of the Herman K. Beebe circle. The biggest company that actually dealt with Silverado was MDC Holdings, whose chief executive is Larry Mizell. Mizell was a big Republican donor. He held fundraisers that George Bush went to. And Mizell had established trust funds done by a Chicago law firm whose partner was Burton Cantor. Burton Cantor was one of the founding fathers of Castle Bank and Trust, the bank in the Bahamas that the Mafia and the CIA were using. He was involved with CIA projects, Mafia projects in California, and other Mafia figures. And here we have his trust, Larry Mizell's trust fund being set up by Burton Cantor's law firm. And Burton Cantor was also a close associate of Lawrence Freeman, the Miami lawyer, who had worked for Paul Helliwell, the CIA founding father, and worked for the Mafia, and had been involved in the big Florida land deal that Robert Corson's SNL was funding. So we find this circle. You start pulling on this thread. You look at the people involved in Silverado, and you're back with the Mafia and the CIA.
Now, how did Neil Bush get involved in all of this? What was his initial connection with Silverado?
Well,
what did he get out of it?
Neil Bush had gone to Denver after getting out of college and was a landman for Amoco, I believe, which meant he went and tried to secure leases so they could drill on the land. And then Bill Walters and Ken Good set him up in his own company. Okay, they were both big Republican donors. Ken Good went to the inauguration party with Neil Bush in Houston in 1988 when Bush won. Bush visited Bill Walters' home in the 1984 campaign. Bill Walters tore up all his brown grass and laid new green grass on his lawn just for George Bush's visit. Because they were pumping money into Neil Bush's company that was drilling dry holes in Wyoming, was not making any money. He was being, basically, his salary was being paid by these people. And his company got a big line of credit at Bill Walters' bank. So they were supporting him. Ken Good put him on the board of directors of a Florida company he had and was paying him over $100,000 a year in director's fees. Outrageous. $12,000 a month was going to Neil Bush for just serving on Ken Good's board. They were basically keeping him going.
Protection money, it sounds like.
Well, you know, it's almost, somebody made the analogy that Neil Bush was sort of like the driver of the getaway car. And, the cops weren't going to shoot at the president's son. And so far, all we've had is one indictment. The CEO, Michael Wise, is the only indictment so far on Silverado Savings.
Now, what about Neil Bush and Silverado? What role did he play in particular?
Well, he was
a
director, and he approved loans to his buddy Bill Walters. He also approved loans to the second largest borrower at Silverado was a Houston con man named Etrine Starnes. Starnes borrowed $77.5 million from Silverado 6 months after he donated $30,000 to the Contras and went and had a meeting with Ronald Reagan and Oliver North. And he also borrowed over $25 million from Continental Savings in Houston that was supported by Mafia money from Herman K. Beebe. And Starnes was also involved with John Riddle, the guy who was transshipping arms to the Middle East, and had gotten support from Allied Bank, Walter Mischer's bank. And he turns out to be the second largest borrower at Silverado Savings. So Neil Bush was basically just sitting on the board, almost like a figurehead, but approving these loans and, helping his buddies out.
And getting paid also for it as a director.
Right, that's correct. Although not nearly as much as he got from being a director on Ken Good's company. Well, I've been working on it for over 5 years. I mean, anybody can probably collect that much information in 5 years. You know, I've got 3 4-drawer file cabinets full of documents that support all this information. But, I mean, you just take one step at a time. And when I first started on the SNL story in the spring of 87 and looking at one deal at Mainland Savings in Houston, when it failed in 86, was the largest failure in the country. and you start running into roadblocks and people not talking and can't get documents and nobody's being prosecuted and the money isn't being tracked and nobody's trying to get the money back, then you start saying something big is going on here and you start pushing. I mean, if we hadn't run into the roadblocks, we might have stopped with that first story. But when you start running it everywhere, people covering up, the government not doing anything, nobody seeming to care where are these billions of dollars went or cared to try to get them back, that's when you start looking. You know you've got a big story. And so you just keep going. I mean, and everywhere I looked, I found something. It was like, I mean, being in the oil business, everywhere you dig a hole, you hit oil. I mean, every rock you turn over, something scurries out from under it. And it was a wonderful story in that sense.
Well, you even have, I mean, divorce decrees were significant. Things like this.
Yeah, well, you know, the documents at the SNLs are not public. The loan documents, where the money went, the closing documents, the public can't get them. Reporters cannot get them. We cannot track the money. We don't have subpoena power. So the things you rely on are lawsuits and deed records, basically. And so the divorce decrees and divorce lawsuits are very, they have a lot of good information in them. In the spring of 86, I was working on stories involving charitable foundations and hospitals that were not doing enough services for the poor. And a business reporter at the Post named Greg C. got an anonymous call from a guy that we dealt with for over 2 years. And his nickname was DT, which was, you know, our short for deep throat. And for a long time, we didn't even know who he was. Well, this guy calls up Greg and tells him that he should start investigating Mainland Savings, and it's deals with a man named Howard Pulver. So Greg starts doing this, and we eventually found out that Pulver and his partners had over 300 companies, and they were doing deals with Mainland all over Houston. And Greg just found himself drowning in a sea of records. There were thousands and thousands of pages of records in the real property records of Harris County on these deals with Mainland. So I was asked just to come help him sort out the records. And we did that, and then we went and interviewed Raymond Hill, the chief executive officer of Mainland Savings. And Hill's attitude was the most arrogant that I've ever encountered in my career as a reporter. And basically, he accused us at one point of stumbling in the same direction as the FBI. And I knew I had a big story, just the way he was acting, like, we can't touch him. And sort of really thumbing his nose at us, that I knew that there was a big story there. And we immediately ran into the mafia. When we were trying to track the deal with Howard Pulver, who lived in Kings Point, Long Island, outside New York, and his partners were all from New York City. They came down and took close to $100 million out of Mainland Savings, left them with promissory notes that were worth, you know, probably less than $10 million. A huge ripoff, and contributed greatly to the failure of Mainland Savings. At the same time he was doing this, Mario Renda was brokering money into Mainland. In fact, there was an indictment in Brooklyn by the Organized Crime Strike Force talking about the money Mario Renda was skimming off of his deposits and placing in various SNLs, and one of them was Mainland. So we knew we had something bigger. We went up to New York City, and we found Renda's partner in this was a guy named Martin Schwimmer, who was also laundering money for the Lucchese Mafia family. Okay, when we went to talk to Howard Pulver and to Martin Schwimmer, we found they lived across the street from each other in Kings Point, New York, which is a very wealthy suburban enclave on the north shore of Long Island, very exclusive. And so here we had Schwimmer pumping maybe $100 million in deposits into Mainland, and the guy who lives across the street from him taking about $100 million out the back door. And so we knew we had something very big then. And then we started tracking Renda. And then we heard about Herman K. Beebe, the Louisiana Mafia associate who was involved in all the failed Texas SNLs. We started tracking Beebe, and then we find Beebe and Renda together at so many different places. I mean, here's a New York Mafia associate, and a Louisiana mafia associate, both at the same places at the same time across the country.
All right, 8:58 p.m. in the Midwest. That was The Clash. We also had PJ Harvey Band, Cello, Crass, Eve Libertine, Thievery Corporation. That was our music tonight. I hope you all enjoyed it. And we had clips from Vice TV, BBC TV, Democracy Now!, and that's about all I can think of on the top of my head. KC Star, KCUR Radio, Public Radio, Kansas City. And then there was a half a dozen clips that we didn't get to play tonight because it was only 2 hours. And we can't run a show longer than 2 hours. And so I'd like to thank everybody again for listening. And there's supposed to be some Utah Phillips in the background, but I'm not even hearing one single banjo. So due to technical difficulties, we're not going to out this one with